Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, our roundtable podcast about what we are watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we'll look at Creed, the latest film in the Rocky franchise, which has been making people cheer and holler and cry. Speaking of which, in our second segment, we'll talk about the things that make us cry and otherwise push our physical lizard brain buttons. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. So stick around.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. If, like the rest of the galaxy, you're about to see the new Star Wars movie, then check out the latest episode of the TED Radio Hour. It's called The Hero's Journey, and it explores the hidden blueprint embedded within our most popular myths and stories, stories like Star Wars. They all share a similar pattern, where a protagonist on a quest endures several trials before emerging as a triumphant hero. Listen to ideas about what makes a compelling hero's journey on the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Find it December 18th at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
It's a big week for boxing and crying, but before we get started, let's go around the table here in historic Studio 44. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And with us this week is our friend Gene Demby in our fourth chair. Gene, what do you do at NPR?
I'm the lead blogger for NPR's Code Switch.
Well, we haven't had you on in a little bit. It's awfully
it's
good
been
to
a nice
see
minute.
You.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
Well, first up this week, released in 1976, Rocky won Best Picture and made a star out of young Sylvester Stallone, who also wrote the script. Almost 40 years later, and after five in-between sequels that met with varying degrees of success, Stallone's Rocky in Creed is now the aging trainer, and Michael B. Jordan is the hot young boxer, the son of Rocky's nemesis-turned-pal Apollo Creed. Creed is directed and co-written by Ryan Coogler, who also directed Jordan in Fruitvale Station. And one of the reasons we wanted to spend some time with this movie, which came out a couple weeks ago, was that Gene was having so much fun on Twitter talking about it. So, Gene, tell me a little bit about where this movie hit for you.
So there was almost no way I would not have loved this movie. It's set in Philadelphia, which is where I'm from. It's all about sports. There's all sorts of class stuff in there, a little bit of masculinity stuff in there.
When you say class stuff and masculinity.
So to back up a little bit, Adonis Creed, who is Michael B. Jordan's character, is the son of Apollo Creed, but he was raised in relative privilege because he's the son of Apollo Creed, right. And he decides to go into a life of boxing. And as Stephen and I and Linda and I have talked a little bit about, boxing is a sport for poor people. You're not going to be a boxer if you are not poor, right?
For the most part, I think that's largely true,
Yeah, I mean, especially in the last 30 or 40 years or so. It's sort of lost a lot of its prestige. And so several characters sort of, as Adonis is going through the process of becoming a better fighter and a more renowned fighter, several characters, including Rocky, sort of comment on the fact that he is not supposed to be there. Like, right. At one point, I think Rocky says to him, like, I can tell by the way you talk that you got some schooling, you know, you're not supposed to be here. Why do you want to do this? And it's also a really visceral movie, right? I mean, these are people who are using their bodies to make their living, and it looks horrible. It looks right. Like a very difficult living that they're trying to make. And so a lot of times, Donnie is sort of trying to prove that he belongs in certain spaces. People sort of like looking him sideways. It's a sort of inversion of the original Rocky narrative where there's this, you know, schlubby Palooka, mm-hmm. who's up against he's the underdog, and he's fighting this super rich black guy, which is the thing we should get back to later.
Yep.
In this case, here's a super rich black guy who's trying to make his name and gain some credibility by doing this sport that he probably would not be in real life.
Yeah. So how is the Philadelphia in the movie for you?
There's a moment in the movie where Adonis gets into a fight with someone at a club. And this dude, and this is like a small detail, and it made my life, has the best Philly beard in the world. The dude he gets into a fight with is like super sharp. It's super dyed and dark. It's just like this thing you see with black dudes have it all. I mean, sort of have one, but it's not nearly that crisp. I grew up with everyone having this around me. And it's just like all these little details. There's a side about John, which is a word that used to irritate the hell out of all the grown people that I grew up around, but I say all the time. There's all these like little details that sort of just are thrown in there that sort of give you a sense of like a place without being sort of overbearing. And they even seem to work in a lot of the Rocky lore into the, there's the Rocky statue that we all know, which is in front of the art museum.
Yeah, which really exists in Philadelphia,
an actual thing. Uh-huh. It actually shows up in the movie because Rocky Balboa in the movie is an actual person who exists. And so he's just a local boy done good. And this is a statue in his honor.
Yeah. It's got a lot of interesting stuff in it. How about you, Stephen?
I really, really enjoyed this movie. And part of what I enjoyed about it is the way that it somehow, manages to have it both ways. It is full of sports movie cliches in that it hits a lot of big sports movie beats. It pays tribute to a lot of what we now know as rote from particularly the first Rocky movie, but it finds ways every step of the way to handle them in smart ways and invert them when necessary. You talked about the way that it inverts the rags to riches saga and gives young Adonis Creed as much to prove as somebody coming at boxing from the other socioeconomic direction. Part of what I love about it is it takes the lesson of the first Rocky movie, which is that it's not about winning the big fight at the end. It is not about, like, vanquishing some enemy. And that's where a lot of, the Rocky sequels really get off track, is they set up the battle between Rocky and evil.
Yeah, too much about
Rocky and communism.
It becomes too much.
And so it's so vital that Rocky, wins one for the USA, or wins one to show Mr. T who's boss, or whatever. And the fight is about proving yourself. The fight is about showing that, you know, whatever internal struggle is causing you to want to box, that you are winning that fight, that you are proving that you belong, and that, like, all the things that you are trying to prove to yourself are not about, like, having your fists held up at the end of the big match.
Mm-hmm. And I want to point out here, you will notice that not with us talking about the movie today is our friend Chris Klemek, who teaches boxing and boxes. But Chris,
his nose is pressed against the glass of the studio.
But Chris wrote a really lovely review of this movie that we published at NPR, and I really recommend that you read it, because Chris comes from a place of being kind of deeply immersed in Rocky lore and this kind of movie, and always writes so intelligently about this kind of franchise. And when Steven talks about the fight being about testing yourself, that is something that I've heard Chris say about boxing, not in the context of Rocky movies, but just in general, his interest in boxing. So I think that, I mean, maybe he got it from Rocky, but I think it checks out in terms of how people, you know, who actually participate in that sport feel. How about you, Glenn?
Yeah, he comes from a place of deep love and deep passion, and I come from the opposite of that place, whatever that place is.
Yeah.
But I did grow up around Philly, and people who grew up in and around Philly, and of course, I was not from the mean streets of South Philadelphia, but the passive-aggressive cul-de-sacs of Westchester, Pennsylvania. Yeah. It's the Holy Writ. It really, really is. Every one of these movies. And I managed to get through my childhood and teenage years without having seen a single one.
Wow.
Seen bits and pieces on the ABC Sunday Night Movie, but that was about it, because this holds no interest to me, this subject. This film is a crowd pleaser. B, a really old-fashioned sports movie. Two things that I go out of my way to avoid. And yet, why did I like this film as much as I did? I was racking my brain, because this film hits, as you said, Stephen, every sports movie beat.
Beats training montages.
Everything we've seen.
Oh, and going to the old trainer, who in this case is Rocky, going to the old trainer who, you know, I'm too old for this, I don't do this anymore. It's
coming
Mr.
back for
Miyagi.
One more big score.
Every beat, every note, every character, basically, you have seen before. And why, when it's on these rails, when the formula is so strong, did I still like it? The word I kept coming back to was restraint. I kept waiting for what a lesser filmmaker would do with this material, which is to pile on the emotion, to stack the deck, to try to trigger some emotional reaction with all the tricks people do to appeal to the emotion, or at least exploit the emotions. Like, you can do it with music, you can do it with lighting, you can do it with overwrought acting or overwrought dialogue, you can do it with all these sentimental flashbacks. None of that happened, and instead, scenes were allowed to land and given room to breathe, have a beginning, middle, and an end without having it jammed in our face, without having everything underlined. There's a scene where Rocky, spoiler alert, gets some bad news, a scene we have seen in thousands of movies, in thousands of movies like this, and it felt unique to this film. It did. It because it was so underplayed. That is not a thing I associate with Rocky, with Sylvester Stallone at all.
But the first Rocky movie is like that. Yeah. The first Rocky movie is underplayed. The first Rocky movie is, and I'm far from the first person to say this, but the first Rocky movie is like a talky indie movie for the first, not even three quarters, more than that.
Right. Yeah.
Probably 9/10 of it. So it is in tune with that, but it's not in tune with kind of what happened to not only the actual Rocky sequels, but like the idea of a Rocky story or a sports movie. And I think what you're calling restraint, I received as sort of the, and it's the same thing, the absence of bombast.
Yeah.
And both emotional and formal bombast that could have been placed into this movie, they've largely just left out. And mm-hmm. I think it's lovely to see such a restrained, as you say, performance from Stallone, who's mm-hmm. really terrific in this
Fantastic.
Movie. And also, there are two fights in this movie that are shot in single takes. And that the way action is shot now is always chopped up into a million little mm-hmm. tiny pieces. Mm-hmm. And they go sort of the opposite way so that the physical space is very real and the physicality of the fight is very real.
Yeah. If your memory of Stallone is of the veiny meatbag days of the mid-90s, the Stop It Where Your Mom Will Shoot, Tango and Cash era,
yeah.
you've seen him do comedy, scare quotes, where he just lunges at everything, mm-hmm. just mugs. And mm-hmm. as he's gotten older, and we had a preview of this, I think he did a film in the 90s called Copland, where
yeah.
he's stepping away from his persona to actually, you know, act. I suspect he might be getting overpraised for it. I don't know, Oscar, I don't care, but it was something I hadn't seen before.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think that whether he's overpraised or not, he is so crucial to this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I find it fascinating when you look at the trajectory of all these Rocky sequels. Who would have thought that Rocky IV with Dolph Lundgren would set the stage for a soulful film? That the action in Rocky IV, you know, would give you this incredibly rich, the son missing his lost father and all that. Like, Rocky IV, you know, they kill off Apollo Creed, and you're like, oh, no, I hate that Dolph Lundgren. You know, that's yeah. what that was for.
Right.
And all of a sudden, they've built up this movie. And it's, in a way, by waiting nearly 40 years, you suddenly maximize the value of Sylvester Stallone's story himself.
It's like how craggy Ethan Hawke is in Before Midnight. It's like, do you know what I'm saying?
Or Mickey Rourke in The Wrestler,
yeah.
where all of a sudden all the things that have happened to Mickey Rourke inform this performance, and suddenly all these weaknesses or perceived weaknesses are strengths.
Yeah.
And so I found throughout this film, I was increasingly more fascinated with what was going on with Sylvester Stallone than I was with Michael B. Jordan. As terrific as he is in this movie, he is much more the young kid who likes punching people and you know, who needs to punch people to, you know, get in touch with
I don't
his...
know.
I mean, I love Michael B. Jordan in this movie.
Yeah.
But I found Stallone's battles more soulful and more interesting.
I don't know. I'll fight you about Michael B. Jordan.
I love Michael B. Jordan.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about Michael B. Jordan.
Can we talk about
yeah.
I'm sure a lot of people want to talk about Michael
it's
B. Jordan.
It's just going to be me sighing. It's going to be the whole thing. Just me sighing.
Just you sighing.
I don't know. What do you think, Gene? Michael B. Jordan, pretty good dude, right?
Really good. I think he also had fantastic chemistry with, I mean, the only people in the movie he's really talking to at length are Tessa Thompson, who plays his love interest. And that relationship is really naturalistic. I mean, the dialogue, they're sort of teasing each other.
Mm-hmm.
I just loved all the scenes with them together. But even the scenes with Rocky, I think when he first is trying to like win him over, like, come on, teach me how to box.
Mm-hmm.
There's a moment where they're sitting in the back of a van. And Rocky sort of relents and is like, I'm going to write out some training for you. And like he's writing, you know, it's just some things he can do. Like you should do the speed bag and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. Michael B. Jordan corrects Sylvester Stallone's spelling. Like it felt real, right? And it felt like their relationship had stakes. Like, again, it's something we've seen a million times, but it felt like that you were invested in. You bought, I guess when the bad news comes, you bought that Donnie Creed really
yeah.
cared about,
yeah.
had some skin in the game.
Yeah.
And in the first Rocky film, you actually knew who Talia Shire was. She was a real character. Mm-hmm. She wasn't mm-hmm. just the love interest. And I felt that they were kind of motioning toward that with Tessa Thompson in this. We got a lot more about her and what she wants out of life and who she is and where she's going than I think, I'm not an expert on sports films, but I think you would normally get in a sports
yeah.
film. Yes?
Yeah, one of the things I really like about that relationship in this movie, his relationship with the Tessa Thompson character, Bianca, is that is really, to me, a meeting of equals, about mm-hmm. as much as you're going to get. There's not really a kind of an up person and a down person. You really do get a very, very much a pair of people who like each other, and they both have a passion. She's a musician and he's a fighter, and they're equally interested in and supportive of each other's endeavors. It's not just he's the boxer and she's kind of standing at all the fights, yelling for him and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the fact, one of the echoes of the first Rocky movie that it might not occur to you unless, like me, you watch these movies close together. You watch Creed and the original Rocky close mm-hmm. together. But one of my favorite things about Creed is the way that Coogler does so much of that relationship between the two of them at her door.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so much of that relationship is about her door. And there's a moment where he is knocking on her door and he's trying to get her to let him in. And you're seeing his back as he's standing at the door. And then she opens the door and that's when you see his face. And to me, it's this lovely metaphor for the way that another person makes you feel seen or makes you feel like yourself. And I was thinking about how much I really, really liked that. And then I was watching Rocky, and there's an entire scene where Sylvester Stallone is at the door of Adrian. The first time he's trying to take her out, he's standing at her door, kind of coaxing her to come out. And her bully brother is kind of nearby, and he's coaxing her to come out. And it's really unexpected, the kind of tone of it and the way that he's so interested in her and so genuine about it. And it's a really kind of odd scene, but it's really cool and sort of sweet. And I can't imagine that's not an intentional echo. But I love the way that he uses that door in that relationship, because it feels like 75% of what they do in that movie is in that doorway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the echoes of the other movies, I definitely felt watching it. I enjoyed it immensely, not having seen a Rocky movie in many, 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 many years. But you do feel when you're watching it, like, I bet that's a reference. And some of them are very, very iconic and obvious. There's a scene of going up the stairs, you know, that you don't have to have seen Rocky to know what's going on.
Right.
To know what's going on there. I think you can enjoy this movie having never seen any of the other films.
I agree.
But you do get a sense that Ryan Coogler's direction is so confident throughout this movie. You really get a sense that he just takes a lot of opportunities to slip in Easter eggs for people who are watching these movies as a continuum.
Can you talk, Gene, about the scene with Donnie running with the kids on the bikes?
That scene.
So the setup for this scene, I won't make Gene describe it because he'll start, I don't know. He'll emote. So since I'm forcing him into this, it's a scene in which one of his training runs, essentially, he's running through the streets of Philadelphia and eventually is joined on his run by a bunch of like kids on bikes.
Right.
Talk to me about that scene.
So early in the movie, we see those kids sort of riding around, and Donnie's like, who are these kids? And Rocky's like, oh, they're just doing Philly stuff. They're just on the motorcycles, whatever. And I guess they start to see him around a lot, and they ask him, like, hey, you're Apollo Creed's son. And he's like, yeah. And they're like, oh, that's cool. That's what's up. And they sort of leave him alone, but they sort of watch him, right? You know, there's the training montage we've all seen. He's like, you know, doing his pull-ups and all this stuff like that. And sort of ends with him running across all of Philadelphia, it looks like. But at one point, he's running up the street, and all these kids on the bikes like see him go by, and they're like, yo, let's go. And they get behind him. They hop on their motorbikes or whatever, and they're flying by him, and the music sort of, the sound drops out, and it's like Meek Mill song comes on. Meek Mill's from Philly. And like, and he's like running on the street, like it's just like his face is contorted with like effort, and they're behind him with their wheels in the air. And I'm gonna get more short here, but there's a lot of conversation about like black pathology and like culture of like underachievement, whatever. But like when you grow up in a place like that, everyone wants you to win. You know what I mean? Like everyone in my neighborhood knew when I got a bad grade on something because I was the smart kid. You know what I'm saying? Everyone wants you to win. And I had never seen that on film before. I'm like, just like, we got you. Like, you know what I mean? Just like this, like he's running up the street. They have their wheels in the air, and he like gets to the gym. And Rocky, who has gotten some bad news, is waiting in the window for him. And he's like, yo, let's go. And I remember leaning forward in my seat at the movie theater, and you're going to bleep this out, but I was like, let's go. Like, I was just so in my feelings, just unabashedly. I was like one of the best feelings I've ever had in a movie theater before.
Wow.
Yeah. That was a great, great scene. I could not follow that at all. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to say one more time how much I love Michael B. Jordan. I think he's a genius in this movie and in everything. I cannot wait to see the next thing he does. I love him to pieces. And if you saw Creed, I would love to hear what you think. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH, on Twitter at PCHH. When we come back, Gene was talking about getting emotional. I was getting a little emotional there myself. We're going to talk a little bit about when you get choked up, emotional, when you cringe, physical, and other instinctive and visceral reactions to movies right when we come back.
Support for Pop Culture Happy Hour and the following message come from NatureBox.com. At NatureBox, they understand that your life is busy and there's not always time to get to the store. NatureBox makes it easy to start snacking smarter. Choose from over 100 tasty options like sriracha roasted cashews and French toast granola. Or fill out your snack profile and get personalized recommendations delivered right to your door. Spend more time doing what you love and less time trying to find parking. Visit naturebox.com/pop and get 50% off your first box now.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Before the break, we were talking about Creed, and, you know, many people have spoken on Twitter. I found often men talking on Twitter about how they cried at Creed. Gene was saying it was emotional for him. I think our friend Chris Klimek has been bragging about how much he cried at Creed, and I think several other people as well.
It's okay because there's punching in it.
Okay, so here's my beginning to this topic. It is so interesting to me how a bunch of dudes that I follow on Twitter were talking proudly about crying at this movie. And I'm wondering whether there's a difference between the socially coded practice of men crying at movies versus women crying at movies. Because when I came out of the recently released Drew Barrymore and Toni Collette movie, it's called Miss You Already, which is what we would call a weepy and a women's picture, they would call it. I didn't necessarily feel like saying I cried was an endorsement of the movie, except as manipulation. But when you see a bunch of dudes on Twitter talking about crying at a sports movie, usually that's meant as an endorsement, no?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Here's my theory, that in our culture, men are forbidden from showing strong emotions, except in this one cordoned off area of life,
sports.
Which is sports.
Yeah.
In sports, in the male mind, sports allow you easy access to very strong emotions. Anger, of course, if something's going wrong. Joy, and especially sadness, I guess, because sports are bound up in this thick stew of nostalgia. Right? A little bit, you can call it daddy issues, or you can call it ideas of what it is to be a man. Stuff with male friendship, camaraderie, and you know, just mutual collective aggression. These things are just so close to the surface that when there's this ball of ready emotion so easily tappable, this is why, of all the kinds of writing that's out there, sports writing, to me, often can exploit emotions that it doesn't earn, can tap something and cause a reaction like this. I didn't feel it with Creed at all, mostly because I don't have that. I don't have that area of my brain cordoned off where all these emotions are really available.
Right. And of course, when I say this, I'm speaking in very broad generalities, right? I know plenty of dudes who cry easily. I know guys who cry at weddings. I know guys who cry at movies. I know it's a very general kind of thing.
And I'll just say this. When I was teaching writing to high school kids, I would say, give me a paragraph about fear, a paragraph about anger, a paragraph about joy. That exercise is so that they see that when they're writing about anger, their language changes from when they're writing about joy. You use different sentence structure, different words, and the young women would write these searching, deeply felt missives about their relationship with their mother or their best friend. And the men, the young men, for fear, I hope I catch the fly ball, for anger, I didn't catch the fly ball, for joy, I caught the fly ball. Because again, it's where you're permitted to access those emotions. It's where society says, go nuts.
I hear you. So Gene, are you a guy who chokes up at movies?
I do not. Although to your point, I mean, the last time I bawled was my girlfriend did a recent rewatch of Friday Night Lights. I knew the series finale was coming. I was like, oh, I've been here before or whatever. You know, and then as soon as Coach Taylor gets on his knee and ties Michael B. Jordan, look, Michael B. ties Michael B. Jordan's cleat. And he says, I just want to let you know how proud I am of you and how far you've come. And I was like, and for like the next 5 minutes, it was just like,
it's so many triggers in one line. That is daddy issue stuff, which I have. That is one of the biggest triggers to make me cry in any piece of entertainment is someone being rewarded for sacrifice. The sense that you have toiled and toiled and toiled and people have finally turned to you to recognize you for
it.
And sportsy stuff. And sports has so much. I mean, my crying at entertainment is so not limited to sports.
I mean, part of it was about, you know, Coach and his wife and their, you know, and I love those characters so much. But a lot of it was just like, you've walked this journey with these people. I never get sad in series finales, but that one, I was surprised that it was like a satisfying cry too. It was like,
Some cries are very cleansing.
Crying is an incredibly cleansing and satisfying thing. Yeah. And I think I talked about this phenomenon on this show when we talked about the movie Amour. in some Oscars omnibus or other.
Mm-hmm.
And how Amour, Michael Haneke directed film about this elderly couple, and it's this, you know, one is slowly dying.
Mm-hmm.
And the movie stuck with me for days and days. It haunted me because he uses almost no music. And so you don't have the swells of strings. They're not there to facilitate the cleansing of the crying, and so the toxins never leave your body. And so for me, among the triggers, among the things that will make me cry at movies, and I cry at almost everything where I'm supposed to cry.
Boo-boos.
I mean, I have cried at some ridiculous things to have cried at.
Clowns.
And, I think I mentioned this on the show, but I think I cried at the end of Hop.
I think that's an urban legend in your own mind.
But it's not, you know, it's not like sobbing. It's not being incredibly moved. It is because music has swelled in a certain way at a certain time in the context of certain things. And The Good Dinosaur, the movie we talked about last week, which none of us particularly liked, there were several scenes in that movie that wrecked me pretty hard because I miss my late father and there are strings. And so a lot of it for me, there are things that are permitted to make us cry, but one of those things is just like some of us are more easily manipulated than others, and I'm very easily manipulated by music and by certain triggers.
Yeah, you know what? We're not inventing new emotions, right? There's only a certain set of emotions that humans are hardwired with.
Glenn is like, I have four.
Hold on.
Maybe three and a half.
For thousands of years.
Disdain?
Okay, okay.
I'm sorry,
go
ahead.
For thousands of years, artists and entertainers have found ways to access them. And I would call any of that manipulation. I don't mean it in a bad way. I mean that you feel a different way once you put down the book than you did when you picked it up. It has affected you. And there are tricks. There are ways to do it. It's very simple. So when you see it and you feel it and it's earned, you know, I've said before that thing I would say in teaching is if you are walking down the street, somebody jumps out of an alley and shakes a dead puppy at you, you will have an instinctive, reflexive reaction. Mm-hmm. Has nothing to do with how well they're shaking that dead puppy, whether or not they're doing it with little curlicues or with what verve and alarm.
This is a very interesting piece of symbolism you've come up with here.
It has to do with, because we're, and so also when you would teach kids and they would come out and they would want to write something that they feel is good, why does, well, A, they would write, the alarm clock woke me up in the morning and it was all a dream. That's how every story begins and ends if you're a kid. But they would also write a tremendous lot about car crashes, dead parents, and, you know, don't bury me, I'm not dead, because they sense instinctively that certain things in our lives come prepackaged with a motive force, and you can coast. And so I don't object to emotions. I hope to have one day. But I object to emotionalism, not sentiment, but sentimentality, which is reaching for sentiment, reaching for real feelings in an unearned way, using all these devices and tropes to distract from the fact that you haven't told a story.
Very curious. All right, now I want to talk about a couple of other visceral reactions, because here's the thing, and people who have been to movies with me before may know this. I have a really difficult time watching scenes where I'm waiting to see if someone is going to get shot, particularly shot. And I have a difficult time with them to the point where I put my fingers in my ears, and it has gotten to the point where I wonder if I'm a weirdo.
Wait, because the sound of the gunshot?
Yeah, well, if I'm sitting there watching a scene where I'm wondering if somebody's going to go around a corner and get shot, I will stick my fingers in my ears. Sometimes I will close my eyes also, but usually it's enough to stick my fingers in my ears and cringe. And I don't know whether it's not, I don't think I'm afraid of the loud sound, although I am also a person who cannot stand to be in a room where someone is acting like they're going to pop a balloon.
Oh, sure.
So maybe it's something like that. So sometimes what happens is if there's a really good movie where I'm constantly afraid someone's going to get shot, I have to watch it until I see where everyone gets shot, and then I watch it again. And now I know where all of that is, and I can appreciate other things about it because I really...
You go back and, like, read the Wikipedia plot summary? Yes.
Oh, I've done that too.
Yeah,
But it's like it is a physical... I can't... If I try to sit in the theater and say, okay, don't put your fingers in your ears... It is very physically uncomfortable, and it is not an emotional reaction in the same way as crying.
Mm-hmm.
It's just this ugh, I can't stand it. It ruins certain suspense movies for me. It's very unpleasant. I don't know. Are you a cringer, Thompson?
Yeah. I mean, I totally see what you're saying about the getting shot. For me, it's much more... it's more specific to specific things that freak me out and horrify me that I can't listen to people talk about. Eyeball horror.
Yes.
Of any kind. And
when
we talked about the Jennifer Lopez movie, The Boy Next Door, there's so many thumbs in eyes. There's so much like...
also needles, I think. maybe both together.
What? Let us never speak of it again. The squishing sound. No, I can't even talk about it. I can't do eyeballs.
But you're also that way about two pieces of styrofoam rubbing together.
I have a thing with styrofoam. It's like a shock to my spinal column.
Steven can't be around styrofoam rubbing against
it. It's fingernails on the chalkboard.
Absolutely.
Eyeball horror and anything. Why do they always have to show the needle entering the sight of? Mm-hmm. There's so many movies want to show you that needle coming in. I don't like needles. Like them. So it's more just visceral. Like, I'm going to cover my face. And when I look up, I expect you to stop trying to fish that out of there.
Yeah.
Ugh. You know, The Martian, that bit where there's like debris in his abdomen and he keeps trying to pick it out of there. Like, no, I mean, I know it's fake. I know it's pretend. I know that Matt Damon is not actually.
You remember being next to me where what was the movie where Nicholas Holt, he has the hand feet, the feet hands?
Yeah, that was X-Men First Class.
X-Men First Class, or is the feet hands? And then at one point, he gets a needle in the foot hand. Oh, that's so gross. I almost crawled under the chair. Oh, my gosh. Needle in the foot hand.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Or hand foot, or whatever it was. Yep. Oh, it was so gross.
That's so funny.
Oh, I had such issues with that.
I don't like jump scares. I resent jump scares. They make me feel so manipulated. It's like, oh, congratulations, you caused an autonomic response. Good for you. And so when you can sense one coming, I look at the lowest corner of the screen and stare straight at that. Hopefully nobody ever has the jump scare start there, because that would my whole plan is undone. But and the other thing is, for many years, for most of my life, fight scenes would bore me. I would just, we have to kind of sit through this thing now. I feel the same way about car chases. We've just seen so many of them. They don't evoke anything in me except boredom. Then, you know, I live in a city, and a few years ago, I got mugged. You know, happens to everybody. And since that time, watching a fight scene is a very visceral reaction. It hits me exactly where I live, because I guess I keep imagining what I could have done differently. I have this aggression. You can tap it. You can tap it by showing me somebody, you know.
Like when you watch what kind of thing?
Any fight scene, really. Like if it's, and it doesn't have to be with music or anything like that. It's just, it's more approachable to me. All of a sudden, like I'd never been in a fight in my life. Yeah. Lily white peppered hands had never touched.
Did you have like any trouble metabolizing Creed? Like when you were watching it, was it like difficult to watch, or did you?
No, it's not difficult. It's great.
Oh, okay.
It's cathartic. I mean, it's like, yeah, that's what I mean.
But how about you, Gene? How are you watching?
Those actually were my two things. I hate jump scares. I think they're, like you said, super manipulative. There's a couple like horror video games that do that. And it's just like, the sound goes out. Like I was very late to The Silence of the Lambs and like all the Buffalo Bills stuff at the end, which is like, it was interminable, right? Mm-hmm. But also in Jessica Jones, there's a scene in which someone injects a needle into someone's eye.
And
I said, and I didn't know this is a thing people actually did.
That's not a spoiler reaction. That's just that.
And I didn't know this is a thing people actually did in real life, but I did this. I put my hands over my eyes and I peeked through my fingers. And I was like, what is going on? And I didn't realize I'd done it until like, you know, 40 seconds into the scene. It was interminable.
Yep.
And I was like, this is stupid and it has nothing to do with anything. And they could have written around this some way. Like, why are they subjecting us to this?
Needle in an eye.
They're like, the only way we can inject this is to get into his optic nerve. And I was like, come on. No, man, listen.
Well, the other thing is, you can say you're doing that without showing it.
Yeah, absolutely. But they held.
But why would you?
Yeah.
But here's the thing.
They want this reaction.
But here's my question. Like, honestly, why eyeballs? Why isn't it as bad if they stick a thumb in an ear? Why isn't that as bad?
Because it's uniquely vulnerable.
Yeah. It's such vulnerable tissue.
Yeah.
The reason I have not gotten LASIK or do not wear contacts is because I'm like, nope, you're not. That's not going to happen. That's not fitting to happen today. Nope.
That's sticking a finger in my eyeball.
It's only the awesome power of vanity that has contacts in my
eyeball. But then why needles, though? Like, why is it needles? Because so many people are that way about needles. It's not like a terrible injury compared to getting like stabbed with a knife. And there are people who would rather see somebody stabbed than get a shot.
Maybe it's like you are relenting. Like, I mean, if you are in the doctor's office, like, we're going to give you this shot. You have to sit still, right? It's like whenever I get my beard trimmed up on my barber, I like sort of freak out a little bit because he's like under here. And I think it's like because you're completely at the mercy of someone else. And you're doing it of your own volition, right? If someone's trying to stab you, I imagine you're...
So the needle, you're like letting them do.
Yeah. So there's a difference between getting a shot and having blood drawn. And I think like having a shot can just be like, you know, punch. Mm-hmm. Where they like stab you with something and you're like, ow, and then it's done.
Yeah.
Whereas it's the sitting.
Unless it's a tetanus shot. In which case it hurts for a week.
Well, yeah, I know. And I'm not saying it doesn't hurt. And I'm saying it doesn't hurt for a while. But like having blood drawn is like sit perfectly still.
Mm-hmm.
If you do this wrong, you will. It's like the same reason like I don't like to lean over balconies. I get vertigo. But if I screw this up, something unspeakably horrible will happen.
Well, this is why I don't like standing on subway platforms in New York. Yeah. Go ahead, Glenn.
But I think in popular culture, there's a difference between how stabbings are generally shot, always in medium shots, right? And the way a shot or blood drawn is shot, which is close up. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think you are closer to that experience than you are when somebody gets stabbed.
It's also a weirdly, it's like slow motion invasion of the body.
Mm-hmm.
That's unnerving.
Yeah. Okay, so we've got...
This is the most squeamish segment we've ever done.
So we've got crying. Mm-hmm. We've got jump scares.
Mm-hmm.
I like jump scares.
Yeah, I don't have a problem.
As long as I know that nobody's getting shot.
It's horrible.
That's the bad kind, because then I have to stick my fingers in my ear. Who knows?
Who was the Russian writer who was like, you know, if you see a gun in the first act, it's like,
check off.
So with you, it was like, if there's a balloon in the first act. It has to pop.
And with Steven, if there's a styrofoam cooler...
I'll just eye it suspiciously the entire time.
Or if somebody has eyes.
Yeah. So we see eyes in the first time. Yeah, I'm trying to think whether there are any other...
Well, laughter, of course, right?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, I was trying to think, and I don't think I have an answer to this question. I think I have an answer for me, which is it harder to make somebody laugh or harder to make them cry? I think it's easier to make somebody cry because honest laughter, not polite laughter, like a belly laugh, that is... hard to come by, mm-hmm. I think.
Mm-hmm. That's why people need to stop writing LOL, because it's not true.
Really not true.
You're devaluing actual L's O-L.
L's O-L.
I don't know. I agree with you, though. I think that is the other sort of involuntary response, right?
Well, mm-hmm. and you know, we're going to be talking about the Oscars soon enough and the best films of the year. And one of our big complaints, or at least one of my big complaints about the Oscars, is they always drastically over-reward dramas.
Mm-hmm.
And I think comedies are harder to do.
Mm-hmm. Maybe. They might be somewhat harder to do.
Like a really great comedy that everybody's like, you have to go, you will laugh your ass off.
Mm-hmm.
That is harder to come by than movies that will make people cry because they have a really good string section at work.
You are a cynic, sir. You're a terrible, terrible cynic. All right. I think that I would be curious to hear about whether you jump at needles, jump at eyeballs, cry at movies, or think that comedy is much harder to do than drama. I think those are all interesting ideas. Come and find us again on Facebook or on Twitter at PCHH and tell us what you think. When we come back, it is going to be time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, What's Making Us Happy This Week? Come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Sonos, the smart system of wireless speakers. Sonos lets you listen to any song in any room of your house, or the same one in every room. Classics in the kitchen, R&B in the bedroom, pop culture happy hour in the living room, and rock and roll in the whole house. Learn more at sonos.com/NPR.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
By the time this episode lands, NPR Music will have launched much of its year-end best-of coverage, which is always a long and arduous process. I'm delighted with the albums that we're highlighting, a lot of stuff that I really love. My own top 10 list will have gone up by the time this goes in. NPR Music launched its 50 albums of the year. There's a discussion show on All Songs Considered. It's a really wonderful time. If you are not constantly marinating in new music, I really recommend going in and just jumping around and sampling stuff, because it is a perfect time to be discovering your next favorite bands. And so that process, it's always a headache, but I'm always so, so happy when it's done, in part because of the discovery that it facilitates. The other thing is I saw a wonderful new movie called Brooklyn, which we have not had a chance to talk about on this show. It is definitely considered an Oscar contender. And when I think about the movies that get nominated for Best Picture, particularly in recent years, I think about movies about men and their deeds and the story of the very important man and the people who misunderstand him. Mm-hmm. And to see this quiet, lovely, subtly emotional story about a woman who moves from Ireland to Brooklyn in the early 50s, and the process of missing one place, feeling alienated in a new place, going back to the old place, and you know, the finding of home is a very universal story. And on top of that, it is a romance in which the central character is sensible. And I cannot tell you like how refreshing that is to see these complicated and emotionally rich stories in which you're not sitting there like, no, dummy, do this. It is a terrific film that's getting a lot of Oscar buzz, and it is one of my favorites that I have seen so far. So Brooklyn.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
The NPR Book Concierge launched on Tuesday. It is the antidote to top 10 lists, top 25 lists. It's
Don't knock those.
I know, but it is gorgeous. It is intuitive. It is useful. You can kind of choose. I contributed to it. I got a chance to write about 7 of my favorite comics and graphic novels from the year. I'm happy anytime that my introduction on this show is not a thin tissue of lies, and I was actually writing about books and comics for the NPR website. So that's great. Check that out. The other thing is pretty brief. It's loveboatinsanity.tumblr.com.
What? Yes, I have seen this.
Okay. If you follow that link, you're going to go to the main page of the site, which is not the best way to ingest this particular content. It's best to subscribe to it in Tumblr so that it keeps popping up in your feed at random intervals. You must understand, I don't want to oversell this. It is one joke. It is a very specific joke that evokes a very specific time and place and mood. And it is that same joke, just iterated ad nauseum, ad infinitum. It just keeps going. But whenever it turns up in my Tumblr feed, it's surprising and wonderful. I don't want to spoil the joke, but just go to loveboatinsanity.tumblr.com.
All right, nice. Glenn Weldon, keeping us all in suspense. Thank you very much, bud. Gene Demby, what is making you happy this week, sir?
I have two things. One, I just wanted to furiously co-sign. Audie Corner shouted out Spotlight at the live show. That is a really, really good movie. It will not make you happy, though. It is not a movie that will make you happy, but it is a fantastic movie. The other thing I want to shout out was this is a genre of thing at this point, people dancing to Beyonce songs.
Yes.
But it's a bunch of people it's called Wildebeest Adams. They're dancing to Upgrade You by Beyonce. It's like fantastic, though. It's like the kind of thing you would play before you need to go in the morning if you're having, like, I need to get ready for this meeting, whatever. And it's like surprisingly good. I mean, you're like looking at these people like, they're not going to be very good, and they're fantastic.
Nice.
They are fantastic. And I was like sitting around watching it on my phone with my friends the other day. We were all like, yeah, just
say what it is again and where we can find it.
It's called Wildebeest Adams. It's on YouTube.
Wildebeest Adams.
Yeah, and they're just dancing to Beyonce's Upgrade You. I'm surprised that this has not entered into my field of vision before, just because this is the kind of things that my friends are uniquely primed to like discover and unearth.
Mm-hmm.
But it has a bajillion page views already, but it's fantastic. It's just fantastic.
I look forward to having that song reclaimed from all the commercials.
Mm-hmm.
Like when you call your song Upgrade You, you know, you might as well call your song like Get the Undercoating as far as how likely it is to be used in commercials.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I'm looking forward to having that song back.
Yeah.
Nice. Thank you very much, Gene Demby. I struggled this week because most of what I did this week was talk to people and watch Law & Order. I always, at any time, have a thing that I'm recording on my DVR endlessly that I just pick up to fill whatever time I just feel like turning my brain off. For a long time, it was Judge Judy and the People's Court. I have recently shifted away from Judge Judy and the People's Court, which is a massive shift in my day-to-day, because I have been taping Law & Order every day. It comes on. Usually there's like 5 to 7 in a given day airing somewhere.
5 to 7 episodes or from 5 to 7 p.m.?
No, 5 to 7 episodes a day airing somewhere, I would say, with occasional interruptions for way more than that. And so I will sit down and just watch some Law & Order. Now, most of these are Law & Order Mothership. This is original Law & Order. Now, most of these I've seen before. Some of them I've seen many times. So I already know who did it. Nevertheless, it is the most comforting, rhythmic format. You know, first you get the little scene where I've always felt that the best possible short film about New York would just be a bunch of the little vignettes of people about to find bodies in the beginning of Law & Order. And so, you know, it'll be like two dudes coming from a hockey game and they'll be like, ah, your wife's the worst. Your wife's the worst. Whoa. And then they find a dead body. And so that happens. And then usually Jerry Orbach in all the good ones, Jerry Orbach and someone come on the scene and check out the dead body. And then he says something really terrible. I mean, if you think that David Caruso on CSI Miami invented the with the putting the shades on. No. Lenny Briscoe was doing that for years. So Lenny says whatever. And then they investigate for a while. They fasten on a suspect who is the wrong one. And it doesn't turn out to be that person. And then they figure out who really did it. And then they go to court and they put that person on trial. And then someone else actually did it. That is not true of every episode, obviously. Mm-hmm. But that's the rough general
idea.
The most
distinguished character actor did it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, yeah. I will say that is a threat and a problem that they have, is that you can often guess who did it or who's going to turn out to be worse than you think, because you think, well, why did they get that actor
Julia
to play
Roberts.
This right to play this like rando, and you know that person's going to turn out to be, if not the person who did it, also a terrible person,
right?
Because otherwise why would that person take the part? My point is, marathoning Law & Order is just one of those classic American television traditions. I am not the first person or the only person to do it by any means. But it is no fooling. It is the most satisfying and strange. The only flaw is I need to go through and fix my DVR because the way that they run these episodes, it's been cutting off like the last 15 seconds, which means like the last like wise, grizzled thing that like the old district attorney says, like the many years that Stephen Hill played the district attorney, he would say like I guess she got what she wanted. And then they all walk out. It says Dick Wolf. That part's been getting cut off.
Oh, yeah. You don't want to lose the Dick
Wolf. So I get the verdict, but not the final little shot when they're all back
judgment,
in the office drinking. So don't try to figure out what channel it's on. You won't. It's on fair. Random channels. Some of it's on Wii. Some of it's on something else. I don't know. Don't worry about it. Put it in your DVR. Tell it, pick up Law & Order.
I think it's been picked up by Birdsong this point.
It will find you.
Wherever it will find you. That is what I've been doing. And that is what, as you can tell, is making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen and Glenn at GH Weldon. You can follow Gene at GD215. That's GEEDEE 215. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are taking your training run to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. If, like the rest of the galaxy, you're about to see the new Star Wars movie, then check out the latest episode of the TED Radio Hour. It's called The Hero's Journey, and it explores the hidden blueprint embedded within our most popular myths and stories, stories like Star Wars. They all share a similar pattern, where a protagonist on a quest endures several trials before emerging as a triumphant hero. Listen to ideas about what makes a compelling hero's journey on the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Find it December 18th at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.